The streetlights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. If you need to catch up on our previous episodes, you can do so on iTunes or wherever podcasts are available, along with suspectconvictions.com. Before we get into this next episode, we wanted to clarify some information we shared earlier. In the third episode, we talked about the trash bag that Jennifer's body was wrapped in. It was a hefty bag that matched the type of trash bags used at the Hillside Inn Motel where Stanley Liggins lived. It was a 30-gallon black trash bag, and the Hefty brand made up 85% of the local trash bag market at the time. That information was based on testimony from Gregory Kerr in the first trial. He was a senior development engineer for Mobil Chemical Company. Former Scott County Prosecutor Bill Davis says more details about the trash bag analysis came out in the second trial.
What you said is correct, but it doesn't narrow down the issue. And that's what we tried to do when we present evidence, so that there'd be some reason to be showing the evidence. We found plastic bags in the well way in the staircase underneath the apartment where Stanley Liggins was living. We compared those bags, or we had the laboratory compared those bags to the bags that were found on Jennifer and on Jennifer's body. It was determined that the bags that were available to Stanley were commercial bags. They are not the bags that you'd buy off the shelf at the grocery store. They're a different size, different allotments, and it's the chemist who was called to testify stated that that's what he found. They were commercial bags and they would not be available on a grocery store shelf.
Now, in this episode, we'll talk about some of the uncertainties that surround Stanley Liggins' case and how they might be addressed in the upcoming trial. The truth is, we'll never know exactly what happened the night of September 17, 1990, when Jennifer was found murdered. When Scott Reeder arrived at the crime scene that night, he says he had one question.
The night that I came onto the playground at Jefferson Elementary School and I walked up on Jennifer's body and I looked down and I saw her. And I could tell it was a child. And the thought that came through my mind is, what kind of human being would do something like this?
So we asked an expert on criminal profiling. Vincent Winselowitz is the chair of criminology at Regis University in Denver. We told him about the nature of the crime, but nothing specific about Stanley Liggins, who has been charged with the crime.
That would classify him in a person that is certainly able to compartmentalize and has no social conscience at all, a true sociopath.
Vincent says the strangulation, sexual abuse, and burning of the body show a desire for a person to feel power over the victim.
Rape isn't a sexual crime, it's a power crime. You know, it's taking that power over other people and applying it to them.
He says the fact that this happened to a child could be another example of showing power over a vulnerable person.
It could be something in his background, but normally when you see people do things to older people, to children, you know, they're picking on a vulnerable group that can't fight back and who will be more fearful. You know, he might have come across a young lady in her 20s that not only would fight back, but not give him the satisfaction that he needed.
After Jennifer was killed, the perpetrator burned her body. Vincent says this has significance for two reasons.
The burning of the body probably indicates total disregard for the human person. And the other piece of it would be a fear of being caught. It's sort of like if I steal a car and I think that, you know, I take it for a joyride and I think that somebody may figure out what my prints are, I'm going to burn the evidence completely.
Stanley Liggins has been charged with the crime. Since his last conviction was overturned, he currently has the presumption of innocence ahead of his new trial. But we were wondering if Stanley's behavior coincided with these descriptions Vincent gave us about who would commit a crime like this. We asked Vincent about an interaction Stanley had with Jennifer. Jennifer's mother, Sherry, says when Stanley would come by their home, he didn't have much contact with Jennifer, except to play a quick game with money.
See, and I didn't even know he was even talking to Jennifer, except that when he'd come, he'd say, here's the change, you count it right, you can have it.
Jennifer had learning difficulties in school, and she was learning how to count money. We asked Vincent how he would interpret this test from Stanley to Jennifer.
There is a power sequence here that the other person knows that either the person will not be able to count the change, or he's holding that over their head as something they want, but he's got the power to control whether they get it or not.
Stanley Liggins has denied our request for an interview, but we do have information from a psychological screening that was done when he entered the Parchman, Mississippi prison in 1982. A correctional psychologist noted that Stanley admitted to using illicit drugs like cocaine, amphetamines, and PCP. He had also been paid up to $200 for sex with men, but adamantly denied being a homosexual. The psychologist wrote there's a possibility of a serious thought disorder, which includes disorganized thinking, delusions, and hallucinations. But the report noted none of these were observed during the interview. The psychologist recommended treatment, but it's unclear whether Stanley received any. As we reported in the fourth episode, Stanley's prison records from his time served in Parchman reveal an alleged attempt to rape another inmate in the shower. And Stanley was convicted of sexually abusing another 9-year-old girl. The incident happened the month before Jennifer was killed. It's important to note that in court, these prior offenses or allegations are not revealed to a jury. The reasoning is past convictions could bias a juror against the defendant. The court acknowledges that past behavior can't be used to suggest somebody committed another crime. When Scott Reeder first came across the crime scene, he wondered who could do something like this. But former Scott County Prosecutor Bill Davis says he doesn't think that way anymore.
I gave up early on in my career in trying to figure out guys, trying to figure out motive, trying to figure out just what the hell they're thinking, because it's not rational. I mean, it's always goal-oriented activity, but it's not rational.
Instead, he says he and the police department got to work trying to piece together a case.
You start, obviously, where you find the deceased and the body, and then tracking down anybody who might have seen something there. And, of course, you have your first responders, and then you follow through with the medical people. And on the Illinois side, you try to track down as quickly as possible anybody who last saw her. And what was she doing when they last saw her?
Jennifer's body was found in Davenport, Iowa, about 3 miles from her home in Rock Island, Illinois. But the prosecution couldn't prove where the murder and sexual abuse took place before her body was found at the school. The state crime lab in Des Moines, Iowa, tested thousands of samples of forensic evidence. Nothing at the crime scene, including Jennifer's body, had Stanley's DNA on it. Bill Davis says any hope for evidence at the scene was burned away.
Whatever it was had been destroyed. I mean, the fire really does destroy.
Forensic samples were also taken from Stanley's motel room and car, but the crime lab did not find a trace of Jennifer in either of those places. Now, almost 27 years after the crime, we have what is called the CSI effect. John Hanlon is the executive director of the Illinois Innocence Project. We heard from him in the third episode. He explains this phenomenon.
Well, the CSI effect, of course, refers to a television show that many millions of people have watched and continue to watch. And the CSI effect is that as a result of watching that show and other shows, that there's an expectation that science and forensics are going to solve the case. And they're going to do it rather straightforwardly and rather quickly. So the effect on jurors is, show me the science. There is that expectation.
John says this puts pressure on both sides.
It puts pressure on the prosecutors because they have the burden of proof. And if jurors want to hear some kind of forensic evidence, then that's something that they're strongly going to look for. And that is sometimes how we end up with what used to be called junk science or flawed forensics being put forward to a jury because prosecutors want to present something. It also, though, puts pressure on defense attorneys because if the prosecution is going to present some kind of forensic evidence and the defense doesn't present any rebuttal to that or their own forensic evidence, the matrix for a jury then can be, well, we heard out science from the prosecution. We didn't hear any from the defense, and that can cut against the defense.
Mike Walton is now the Scott County attorney who will prosecute Stanley Ligon's third trial. He has declined our requests for interviews before the trial. But Bill Davis says Mike will be able to work in spite of this effect television might have on a potential juror.
You know, Mike was my first assistant for a long time, and Mike's a very skilled trial lawyer. I'm very confident that he'll handle that issue and put that dispel some of those obligations. For one thing, we are not reinvestigating the case. This is what was available to us at the time, and your obligation is to see whether or not it proves to you beyond a reasonable doubt just the crime, the elements of the crime, and whether or not he committed the elements of this crime. Not what we didn't do or what we failed to present to you, even though the defense will probably argue that.
In the first two trials against Stanley, the prosecution used several eyewitnesses to build their timeline of the events that happened the night Jennifer died. And Bill says these witnesses allegedly placed Stanley Ligon's in key places along the way.
Witnesses are always better after they go to the Bill Davis woodshed. After you explain to them, there's ways to say things. Sometimes you can say something and just open yourself up like crazy without intending to. But if you just answer questions in a certain manner and be honest and don't volunteer, of course, you'll do much better. And here's some other things that you can expect them to be asking. Don't get excited. Answer the question. And they came across fairly well. The questions that the areas that you think that there are going to be a problem, you handle in direct examination. You don't leave them like they do on television, open for the defense to come in and drive their truck through. You try to close that up as much as possible. And they were really pretty decent witnesses.
In 2013, Stanley was granted a new trial when an Iowa appellate court upheld the defense's claim that the prosecution withheld police reports from the defense. According to the appellate court brief filed by the defense, one of the reports they're missing was allegedly filed the night of the murder. They say this report includes information from an interview with a witness that reportedly told police she saw three white men at the scene of the fire where Jennifer's body was later found. The appellate brief states that if the defense had this information before the trials, it could have been used to point away from Stanley. The appeal states a woman named Sarah Klingsick claimed she was driving by Jefferson Elementary School with her daughter the evening of September 17, 1990. She said she saw a white car with three white men. One of the men got out of the vehicle and stood next to a small fire in the grass. Sarah allegedly called 911 that night to report the fire. Then she went home briefly and returned to the area after first responders had arrived. She says she was questioned by police that night, but the defense brief claims Stanley's attorneys never received the report. In a post-conviction hearing in 1999, Sarah testified about what she could remember from that night. She said she stopped her car and spoke with the man who was standing outside of the vehicle. She asked what they were doing, and the man allegedly said they were just having fun. When the car drove away, Sarah testified, her daughter took a blanket out of the trunk and they tried to put out the fire. She said the flames were too intense to see what was burning, but she assumed they were logs. Scott and I talked to Sarah last month. Here's what she told us about that night.
A man had got out of the car and he's just laughing, talking all loud and drinking beer. He had beer and stuff. So I told my kids, I'm not, because I had my children in the car, I wasn't going to go any farther. But something told me to sit there. So I sat there. And the next thing I know, I've seen a figure on the blaze burning, and it was swirling and swirling and swirling until it fell over on the ground.
But the autopsy report states Jennifer had already died before she was set on fire. In fact, Stanley's second defense attorney, Mike Toby, says he doesn't believe this witness.
But, you know, I have to say I've always been amazed at the number of people who just happened to drive up that hill next to that school on that night.
Okay.
Including you. I mean,
I was there. I honest.
It just seems like everybody and their best dog drove by that school off of Marquette that night.
And Bill Davis says Sarah is completely unreliable. He disputes her story of what happened the night of the murder. And he says if she had reported that story in 1990, police would have investigated it.
I don't believe it at all. I know the officers very well. I went door to door and went to her door, and she gave a different story to him at that time. Why would he? You know, the case is new and fresh to us. We haven't charged anybody yet. We're just gathering information. Why would he alter anything that she said?
Sarah's son served time at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, where Stanley served time after he was convicted.
Well, I didn't hear about it until after I convicted the man that she was so certain was innocent twice. Then she comes forward and testifies to something just didn't happen. And she testifies after she had visited with her son in prison, who knows Stanley, and she's able then to come back and get the information passed to her through her son that she wants, or he wants, presented. Also, at that time, her daughter was a friend of one of my daughters, and I can't believe that they wouldn't have said something to my daughter.
We've been interviewing people about this case over the past 6 months or so, but they're having to recall events that happened over two decades ago. We talked to a memory expert about how memories form and why they change over time. Sherry Berkowitz is an assistant professor of criminal justice administration at California State University, Dominguez Hills. She researches eyewitness memory, false confession, and the causes and consequences of wrongful convictions. She testifies about eyewitness memory in civil and criminal cases across the country, but does not have a connection to Stanley Ligon's case.
There's a number of challenges that exist with relying on eyewitness memory 26 years after a crime, because naturally, memory fades. We forget things. We misremember things. And what the research shows is that the more time that passes from an event, the easier and easier it becomes to distort a person's memory.
She says a number of factors could influence what witnesses can remember today.
It's possible that in the 26 years after the crime, they've been exposed to what we call post-event information. Information, any information that we would receive after the original crime. Maybe they've been exposed to suggestions or this misinformation, this false information. For instance, what would these witnesses have seen in the media, in the newspapers? I know you've been reporting on this case for a while. Would the witnesses have talked to each other? Are all the witnesses even still alive? Have the witnesses been exposed to any photographs of either the crime scene, the perpetrator? All these sorts of things can seep into our memory.
So she says it isn't surprising if a witness says something different today than they said during previous testimony.
The more that we reconstruct them, the more that we share them, sometimes we notice the stories start to grow, just like a little game of telephone, where we come and adopt little bits and pieces of misinformation, and next thing we know, that's the story we're telling year after year after year.
Gary McHenrick, Stanley's first defense attorney, explains why eyewitness testimony isn't completely reliable in court.
You see that all the time in trials. You know, witnesses have different perspectives, and you know, people literally see things that never happened.
Difficulty remembering details doesn't only apply to the eyewitnesses in this case. As we've been interviewing people for the podcast, everyone involved has had trouble recalling certain details. Even Scott Reeder. He remembers arriving to the crime scene that night at the same time as the first police officers, and he says they watched the fire trucks arrive. but Dave Parrick, one of the firefighters at the time, says they were the first to arrive. Dave Parrick is now a captain in the Davenport Fire Department. Scott went to talk to him at the fire station about what they could remember.
You know, it's been 26 years, and I remember getting there the same time as a patrol officer, but I don't remember the... And being there at the same time you guys hosed her down, but that doesn't... You know, I don't know. 26 years is a long time.
Yeah. We, I believe we were the only ones on scene at first until after we put the call out. Like I said, once we figured out what we had, you know, that pretty much drew your focus.
Sherry Berkowitz, the memory expert, says traumatic or emotional events are more easily remembered than everyday events. But she says even in a case like this, memory isn't perfect.
When we think about how memory works, it doesn't work like a DVR or a computer. Memory is reconstructive, and so every time we remember an event, we are taking bits and pieces of what we've stored into memory, and we're reconstructing them to recreate our memories, the crime, this fire. And so it's important to understand, too, that when we think then about memory, even memories in this case for a highly, potentially traumatic, violent event that you witnessed, these types of memories, just like everyday memories, are not burned into our brain.
We don't know how eyewitness testimony will be handled in the next trial. Some of the witnesses have died, Jennifer's stepfather can't be found, and other witnesses will be remembering events from nearly 27 years ago. The current prosecutors and defense attorneys have declined our requests for interviews, but pretrial hearings will begin in February, and we'll get a better idea of how this case will progress. Former prosecutor Bill Davis says in instances where people are unable to testify again, the lawyers can read from the transcripts of the first two trials.
It's no substitute. It's not a good substitute, but it's the only thing we have.
The plus side is a new jury won't hear statements that had been objected in previous testimony. If an objection was sustained, that statement would not be read in court again. Bill says witnesses who will testify again might be able to read the transcripts to remember the details they testified about previously.
Obviously, memories fade. Mine's faded. Everyone's faded. However, you have transcripts to refresh memories, and people have a right and an obligation to have their memories refreshed.
Now, as the defendant, Stanley could potentially ask for a bench trial, meaning a judge would decide the verdict instead of a jury. John Hanlon from the Innocence Project explains the process for deciding between a bench or jury trial.
I guess the first thing that's most important to know is it's not the lawyer's decision. It is ultimately the decision of the defendant. The role of the lawyer is to give advice and to give counsel, of course, to the defendant, but ultimately it's the defendant who will be questioned by the judge to determine bench or jury.
Stanley's second defense attorney, Mike Toby, says this will be a tough decision.
This is a case where that might be the toughest call anybody could ever make, because at this point, with the integrity problems that the state's case has, combined with the lack of any forensic link between Stanley Liggins and the crime, from one side of the river to the other, those are things that a judge can dispassionately look at.
And Mike Toby thinks a jury would be more critical of Stanley and the defense attorneys.
In their minds, he is an evil child rapist killer, period. He's been convicted of it twice before and needs to be convicted of it again because he is a bad, bad man, and the lawyers who represent him are evil, evil, evil people too.
He says many defendants like the idea of it only taking one person on a jury to have a reasonable doubt and find them not guilty. But in this case, Stanley has already been found guilty by two juries. John Hanlon weighs the pros and cons of either a bench or jury trial.
I will say this, it is somewhat of a default position for many lawyers to say if it's a high-profile child murder case, a gruesome case, a sexual assault case, that sometimes, because those details are so graphic, including pictures for a jury, that the default is to lean toward having a bench trial. I think that that can be a wise move. I'm aware of cases where that has worked, and I think it can be a very dangerous move for several reasons, one of which is that the judge is just one person. He's a person who has to exist and work and practice in that courthouse. He's a person who walks in the grocery store and encounters people who are his neighbors. And there's a lot of pressure in these cases to render certain verdicts. Let's make no mistake about it, especially in these high-profile cases. And the other reason that it's very very risky to go with a bench trial is because if there is an error during a jury trial, well, we've seen what happens. Appellate courts look at that, and in this case, send it back twice for a new trial. But if there is some alleged error during the course of a bench trial, it's much, much more difficult to get a new trial for the defendant, because the presumption is judges know the law and that any errors were disregarded during the trial.
Scott County Judge Marlita Grieve will preside over Stanley's next trial. Mike Toby says he trusts and respects her.
She has the courage to do what ought to be done, and I would not fear having her decide this case.
Kent Simmons is the lawyer who filed Stanley's appeal. He's not on the defense team, but his work overturned Stanley's conviction in this case. Kent has also declined our request for an interview. But Mike Toby thinks Kent Simmons believes Stanley is completely innocent. Mike, however, doesn't totally agree.
I just don't think Stanley is totally unconnected with what happened. That does not mean that I necessarily think he is guilty of aiding and abetting or what you've heard me say. I don't believe that he actually committed the homicide and the destruction, attempted destruction of the body or the sexual abuse. I don't think he did. You know, Kent spent a lot more time with Stanley, too, than I ever did. I was never a hand holder. In this case, though, I know Kent has spent a fair amount of time with Stanley, even though Stanley's in custody.
And of course, Bill Davis doesn't agree with Kent Simmons' belief in Stanley's innocence. But Bill says Kent is a top-notch lawyer, and he was Bill's first law clerk when he got elected.
He's got an excellent legal mind, and he is zealous in his pursuit of what he thinks is fairness.
Bill didn't want to comment on the potential for a bench trial. But he said if there is a jury, their emotions could be swayed in a different way than Mike Toby suggested.
You know, and you've got to worry that some people are going to think, well, hell, he's been in jail all this time. He's paid his dues. You know, that he's been punished enough. And you got to watch out. You got to make sure that the jury understands that that's not part of the equation. Their only job is to determine whether or not you proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
As we've said, a defendant's prior convictions aren't told to a jury. So Bill says the fact that this is Stanley's third trial will have to be addressed to a potential jury in some way without sharing specific details of why the case is being tried again.
It'll have to be addressed in some form because there's some 20 years between the incident and this trial, and what happened in between. The jury is going to be, they have natural curiosity, of course. So the defense lawyers and the prosecutor will make a determination. If the judge agrees, they'll handle it in a certain way. Generally, you just tell them there's been a prior trial, and even though there's been a prior trial, there's been a decision that this case must be tried again. Are you able to look at the evidence in this particular case, put out of your mind anything that may have happened before in another trial, and make this your decision solely on what's brought to court today?
Bill says it's uncommon for a murder case to go to trial for the third time. But it could benefit the prosecution, he says.
Every case I've tried and every one I've observed, the state's case almost always gets better when they get to do it again.
John Hanlon also considers this situation as rare.
It just statistically and factually and practically does not happen that often. If a case goes back for, say, a second trial, which alone is to some degree, not not frequent. Usually the impetus is to get it right the second time, that the error that the court noticed in the first appeal is corrected in the second appeal, and everybody wants to get it right so that they don't have to risk having a third trial and all that goes with that. So it's extremely unusual.
If Stanley is found not guilty, he would be released for the first time in more than 26 years. Bill Davis says he has faith in the current prosecutors, but he is worried that the defense team's potential strategy of placing blame on the police and the stepfather and anyone else instead of Stanley could distract jurors from what he believes to be the truth.
Look at O.J. Simpson. And if we have a weak judge, and I don't know that we do, I don't know this judge, and let some of that in that's not relevant and should not be part of the case, we could have a problem. I don't know what's going to happen. It's concerning.
Bill says Stanley would be a threat to society if he's released. And Jennifer's mother, Sherry McCormick, agrees.
I hope and I pray that Jennifer, rest in peace, that man does not get out of prison, jail, Scott County jail, to harm another child. Period. And I won't let him have that day. I wouldn't want him to have that chance to get out in this world again to harm somebody, or to where I probably would go off on him, because I do want one-on-one. And that's just to speak, how do I say it? Speak with him, one-on-one.
She says she wouldn't try to hurt him, but she believes he's guilty and needs to be held accountable.
I'm not that way to harm anybody, but I just feel an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And that man, you know, he was convicted, life with no parole, and that's what he deserves. He's lucky he wasn't put to death.
Next time on Suspect Convictions, we'll have a panel discussion with hosts and contributors of other crime podcasts, as well as a crime writer, to talk about the case so far. If you have questions, leave them on the Suspect Convictions Facebook page or tweet them with the hashtag #SuspectConvictions. Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. Big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. You can go to suspectconvictions.com for more information. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.